It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
Thanks for staying with us into the second hour of our program on this Monday morning, July the 6th, 2020. Going to be talking to Paul Vialis of CBS News. I believe he's actually with us already. Let's get right into it with our CBS News correspondent, Paul Vialis. Thanks for joining me this morning.
My pleasure, Dave. Good morning.
Good morning. So you, I gather, have been following the case of this. Am I pronouncing this right? Jillian Maxwell.
I definitely go with the Maxwell part. I don't know. I've heard her first name pronounced a couple of ways. I don't know.
Okay. G-I-S-L-A-N-E or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
G-H-I. I don't know. It's
I just call
unusual
her
Maxwell, name.
Amongst other things. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And she, of course, is a longtime associate of Jeffrey Epstein, the notorious sex criminal who seemed to have a lot of connections among the rich and powerful. She has been arrested in New Hampshire just last week. And there's a lot of speculation about the secrets she may be able to share with folks in law enforcement about some of the powerful and rich people she's hung out with over the years. What do we know?
Well, what we know is she knows where the bodies are buried, Dave. I mean, that's a fact. There's no question about that. And, mm-hmm. and she's a very cunning individual. So she will use this as leverage. Now, also bearing in mind what we have right now is when the FBI and the federal government go after somebody, they're very meticulous and they take their time. You know, hence the old phrase, don't make a federal case out of it. They're very, very meticulous. So rest assured, before they executed that search warrant, they had already gone to the assistant U.S. attorney and sold their case to them. They're relatively positive at this point. They have a very solid case, probably starting with conspiracy, aiding and abetting, as well as, you know, very possibly direct participation in charges relative and relating to human trafficking. So as far as that goes, as far as the government having a strong case, that's a safe bet. What equally is safe a bet is that she is sitting on a ton of leverage. So if I were a betting man, and I'm not, but if I were, I do not see this case going to trial. I think she's going to plea. I think she's going to drop a plethora of very, very wealthy, powerful names so that the government will make a deal with her and they will get who they're looking for out of this.
And I wonder, to what degree can information that is shared by somebody in Ms. Maxwell's position, you know, somebody who is facing very serious criminal charges herself, so obviously there are some credibility issues connected there already, and she's now basically offering up other people. And does that information about the other people stick, or is it discounted? Somewhere in the middle of that range, just because,
that's a very,
you know,
good point. It's a very good point, Dave. It's a very good point. This won't be hearsay. It won't be third-party information. It would be her direct involvement with other individuals, number one. Number two is, given how cunning an individual she is and how manipulative she is. Now, bearing in mind, Dave, this is a woman who spent years manipulating young teenage girls into human trafficking. At least that's what's being alleged, right?
Yep.
So chances of her not having video evidence and tape recordings and the quote-unquote black book are highly unlikely. I don't think she's going to come to the table with speculation. I would be surprised if she doesn't come to the table, as I mentioned before, with a plethora of hard evidence against a number of very wealthy, powerful people. Rest assured, the government's going to want that.
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, in a sense, would she then have been, you talk about cunning and manipulative, I mean, I suppose if she were extremely in that way, she might have been just kind of intentionally gathering such hard evidence over time so that she would be exactly have these bargaining chips if they ever might be needed, right?
Which is exactly my point. That's the kind of person from a behavioral standpoint that you're looking at. Anyone that would do what she did, the length of time that she did it, tried to play the victim card and played it very poorly, by the way, would not walk away from the table without something that was going to protect her.
Yeah. Wow, what a world. I mean, you know, this is
kidding, my friend.
This is out of my league, I got to tell you, and I'm happy and grateful, frankly, to say that. But I mean, these people are, I've never really understood the any of the motivations here. You know, why does anybody even engage in this kind of behavior with underage people and put other human beings in such an unfortunate victimization position like this? I don't get it from the get-go, but go ahead.
You know what, Dave? You don't get it because you're a good guy. You know, good guys aren't supposed to get this. You know,
yeah.
I mean, these are people that are quintessential sociopaths, narcissistic people, overly controlling people. They're individuals that feel because they have a lot of money that people are property. They're like furniture. And they buy mm-hmm. and sell them as they would anything else. And it's people like that, and I've arrested more than them that you can imagine. It's people like that that will sit at the core, at the very apex of human trafficking, or the funding of it, the organizational structure of it. Those are the ones that buy and sell human beings in this world. So for the government to be able to get to that level, do not be surprised if she doesn't go to trial, if she can deliver on those individuals with evidence that the U.S. attorney feels they could move forward with.
Yeah. One of the people who... I guess it was frequently photographed socializing with Jeffrey Epstein, of course, was our president, Donald Trump.
Epstein socialized with a lot of people, Dave. I mean, you always got to look at the other side. You got to respect your opponent. Epstein was a piece of garbage, but he was smart. He knew the circles to play in to get what he wanted. So you also see him frequently photographed with, you know, prior President Bill Clinton, with Prince Andrew. So he played in the right circles because he knew that's where he would benefit from, and that's what would give him the access that he wanted. So, you know, I'm sure there's going to be a bunch of names that are going to be tossed out. The bottom line will come down to whatever evidence this woman, Maxwell, can produce to provide leverage for herself. Jury's out on that, literally, so we'll see what happens there. But something tells me you and I are going to be talking more about this in the weeks and months to come.
Yeah. All right. Well, I don't know. It's so sordid, I almost wish we didn't have to. But on the other hand, you know, as a news item, it's kind of fascinating. Well, it's a slice of human life, I guess, that just you kind of go, what the? Yikes.
Yeah, and,
anyway.
And you know what, Dave? A message to all your great listeners in Waterbury, think about it, right? Parents, know exactly what your kids are doing, you know?
Yeah.
Always know what they're doing. And don't be afraid, you know, to be a parent. You're not their friend, you're their parent. And know who they're communicating with. Know who they're online with. Monitor their social media chatter. Monitor all of it. That's where this stuff starts. So that's a strong lesson for everybody.
Yeah, that's an important message there, Paul Vialas of CBS. I really appreciate you joining me this morning to share it, and we will talk soon. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Dave. Have a good day.
All right, let's go to work. I think we have a caller on the line. Is Fred from Newbury still with us?
Yeah, I am.
Hey, good morning,
Dave,
Fred.
Do you think the people responsible for witness protection can prevent Maxwell from committing suicide?
Of course, you're asking the question of what happened to Jeffrey Epstein. He was incarcerated and was suddenly dead. And I guess the official line there is a suicide. A lot of people have questions about that. I don't know. I who knows? I mean, they were not able to prevent the death of Jeffrey Epstein. I don't know. It's really hard to speculate. I hope so. You know, if justice needs to be done here, and this woman could be key witness in bringing some justice, then let's hope she stays alive long enough to do that. And I can't tell you whether she will or not. Obviously, I don't have any inside knowledge of.
If she does commit suicide, it'll be the biggest scandal in the 20th century. I mean, can you believe it?
Well, except that it's the 21st century, Fred.
Oh, the 21st century. Hey, look, when you get old, you forget. So anyways, it would be unbelievable. I mean, I can't imagine the government allowing her to commit suicide. And if they can't prevent it, then they're inept.
The question is sometimes whether whether they want to prevent it. You know, that's another question.
That's a good point, Dave. Now, my question is, would you like to go in the witness protection program?
No, I wouldn't. I don't want to live a life that ever lead me to be lead me to have to go into the witness protection program. I'd say fairly innocent life, and I'm glad that I never hung out with Jeffrey Epstein or Gillian or whatever her name is, Maxwell.
I agree with you, Dave. I had an innocent life too. I wouldn't want it any other way.
Yep. So I, you know, who the heck knows? I mean, I think that in some ways this story is sort of a the salacious and scandalous aspects of it kind of gross me out. But on the other hand, human trafficking is a serious issue in our society. And if this woman was involved in a circle of human traffickers, I hope she and all of her cohorts go away for a long time. And that's pretty much the bottom.
But due process is important, right? So you're saying, and I agree with you, she's got to have due process. And if she commits suicide, then, doesn't sound too good to me.
No, I agree. I agree. I mean, I hope that, folks are smart enough to realize that they basically just can't let that happen. And to have her die following Jeffrey Epstein's death would be, just really, on the other hand, then you have to ask yourself, so who would bring the consequences there? You know, I mean, really, there have been no heads have rolled that what's that?
The federal government would have to be in charge, because I would imagine the federal government is protector now, because that was a federal crime.
Yeah, well.
So the federal government would be responsible for her protection. And if the federal government can't protect her, so she can, you know, have a trial, then something's wrong.
Yeah. All right, well, Fred, I got to go, but thank you for the call, and let's keep our eye on this one. It's going to be a weird case for sure, either way. Anyway, it turns out. Already is a weird case. I need a dose of happiness. And I said to myself, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to bring on the program today Ginny Sassaman, a writer and a Unitarian preacher from Calais, who just produced a book called Preaching Happiness, Creating a Just and Joyful World. And we need some of that right now. So let's talk to Ginny Sassaman for this next bit of the Dave Graham Show here at WDEV FM and AM. I believe she joins us on the phone right now. And Ginny, I don't know if you knew this was going to be a rescue operation today, but it might be what's happening.
Yeah, I mean,
here.
That was quite a setup. Yeah, no question. No question. I think it was an ancient Confucian, I believe, curse. May you live in interesting times.
Uh-huh.
We are in interesting times. We are in interesting times. And from my perspective, that is why we need to understand and to nurture and cultivate happiness, both personally and for the greater good, more than ever. To me, it feels like the times are very precarious, but at the same time, full of hope. We were not headed down a good path in so many ways. And the upheaval that we're in is actually providing an opportunity for us to move forward in a much more positive way. And for me, that is where happiness comes in.
Yeah, and I want to talk to you about the connection between your personal happiness and your and sort of social happiness, because you've been very involved in Gross National Happiness USA and efforts to promote happiness as a standard by which to measure social indicators. So that's sort of the macro level of happiness. The micro level of happiness, I've been reading in your book over the weekend and finding, many discussions about how people's own personal thinking and habits of thinking really can have an influence in their own lives and then make them better participants in efforts to enhance the broader social happiness. So talk to us about that connection there between, I guess, I'm calling it the micro level and the macro level, but maybe you have better terminology for it.
Micro and macro work for me. I think of it mostly in terms of individual happiness and well-being and communal or systems change for happiness and well-being. But macro and micro, same thing. There's a lot of books out there right now on, especially on personal happiness. There's been a whole movement for, I don't know, a decade or two at least, with the growth of positive psychology, which is wonderful. It's really bringing science to look at not only what do we humans need to get through the day, a day when there's, really distressing headlines, or just a normal day when there's always something that kind of goes wrong. What do we need not only to get through the day, but to thrive, to be our best, to be our most joyful, our most loving, our most compassionate, to really, during this time that we're on the planet, how can each of us make the most of it? So there's that. At the same time, there has been brewing a kind of a systems happiness movement. It's been around for a long time, and there's a great speech that Bobby Kennedy gave in 1968 where he talked about how our measurement systems, our policies, don't focus on the right things. We're focused on money. The GDP, the gross domestic product, just measures kind of the exchange of goods and money. But it can be on building prisons. It can be on cleaning up oil spills. It isn't necessarily on what makes life wonderful and joyous and beautiful and meaningful. So along came the country of Bhutan. And they first started developing a system called Gross National Happiness. Now, I know many listeners in central Vermont wonder about Bhutan, and there was some question of issues of brutality involving Nepalese refugees. So it's not like Bhutan is a perfect country, because no country's perfect. But they came. Mm-hmm. They had this great, great idea that instead of making policies based on money, really, which is what we're mostly focused on in this country, the GDP, money, material success, but instead to have a whole framework that looks at all the different aspects of life that make us happy. So our health, the education of our children, a beautiful environment, and making decisions that take all of those factors into consideration. So So I came into the happiness movement through that. I love the concept of GNH. And to me, it's so practical. It's so practical. It's just saying what really matters, what really matters to us all. And stepping away from this very narrow-minded focus on just a piece of what's important. But as I was studying GNH and trying to understand it and trying to understand how it might be put into effect and how to communicate it to the public, I also realized that, you know, all movements are made up of people, individual people, and the work needs to be on a personal level as well. So I then began really exploring, well, what is it that really leads to a thriving, happy, meaningful personal life? And it all goes together. It all goes together. Yeah. Because we're all connected. And
we are all connected. And I one thing that I think people need to understand about the idea of gross national happiness is that there are some pretty solid ways of measuring the different kind of ingredients that advocates of gross national happiness as a standard can account for. And so tell us a little bit about what are some of the measures that countries that are starting to, or programs that are starting to look at gross national happiness as a measure of national well-being. Some of the smaller measures they're looking at?
Happy to do that. I want to just add one little piece here, just because okay. of the moment that we are in terms of, well, really both COVID and healthcare and how that should be. That should be an important part of our policy framework, but also the rising up of the Black Lives Matter movement. And mm-hmm. I think that one of the pieces of GDP and the focus on money, which to me kind of translates into, you know, I want all I can get for me and my buddies. And it ends up with a system with a few people at the top who are extremely wealthy and many other people who are oppressed and exploited to create that wealth for others. And in this mm-hmm. country, that has certainly been a lot of the people who are the workers who are getting exploited are people of color. Whereas a system that says, let's look at the well-being of all the people and let's look at all the factors that support that well-being, to me, that making that systems change could be a big, big way of reducing both income inequality and of, you know, really combating systemic racism. So I think that's an important piece. It's always important, but I think it's especially important to raise that up right now.
A great way of kind of tying the project to a very topical and, as you say, important issue. Ginny Sassaman is my guest. She's the author of Preaching Happiness, Creating a Just and Joyful World. We're going to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS news and a couple of words from sponsors of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. We'll continue our conversation with Ms. Sassaman when we return, and we will, I hope, take some listener calls. I'm eager to hear what listeners might have for questions for Ginny Sassaman, our guest, and we'll be back shortly, folks. Stay with us.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back, and I want to make a little announcement. I wanted to mention the fact that normally I'd be saying about this time of the Dave Graham Show on a Monday just after the 10:30 break that don't forget at 11 o'clock we have a news conference coming with the governor, but that is not the case today. The governor has been holding news conferences about the state's response to the COVID-19 crisis every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. WDV's been carrying them live, and we're changing up the schedule starting this week. The governor is going to, I guess, slow the pace of these news conferences down to twice a week from three times a week, and it appears the schedule is calling for them to happen on Tuesdays and Fridays. So we will not be carrying the governor's news conference today. Instead, we'll go to Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre after the Dave Graham Show. But the governor's news conference will be on WDEV just after 11 o'clock tomorrow morning, and then again on Friday, updating folks on what the latest is on the governor's efforts to slowly reopen the Vermont economy and restore some degree of normalcy in our the lives of our state's residents. All the work of the top state officials, including Health Commissioner Mark Levine and others who have been so dedicated to trying to work through this crisis in Vermont, has been paying off. I got to say, Vermont's numbers are looking relatively good compared to what is happening in many other places. And it seems as though a lot of the strategies that our state officials here have been using in response to the COVID crisis have been about the best you can do. And so hats off in that regard. They have obviously more work to do, as we all do, and they'll be talking about that on Tuesdays and Fridays going forward on these regular news conferences that WDEV will broadcast live. So on Tuesdays and Fridays, just keep the knob right where it is, and don't touch that dial, as they say, and you'll be able to tune into the news conferences on the COVID-19 crisis just after the Dave Graham Show. So, all right. Well, I want to get back to my guest this morning is Ginny Sassaman. She's the author of Preaching Happiness. It's Creating a Just and Joyful World, a new book just out. It's actually a interesting kind of structure for a book. It's really a collection of sermons delivered at Unitarian churches in Vermont, I think mainly or perhaps even exclusively at the Unitarian Church in Barnard. And talk to me a little bit, Ginny, about the history here. How did this book come to be, and do I have it right that this is that's primarily what it is, and where it happened?
Yes and no. All of these sermons were originally delivered at the church in Barnard, mm-hmm. but I've given the sermons at other churches in Vermont, in particular my own church that I'm a member of, the Unitarian Church of Montpelier, but mm-hmm. others like in Jericho and Washington, Vermont, and Barrie. So the idea of this book came to me because this has been my passion, and the concept of gross national happiness can seem a little esoteric, a little hard to grasp and really understand, even though it's not actually, it's fairly simple, but it seems something that's kind of, you know, for the economists or the social sciences on the one hand. And on the other hand, there's positive psychology, which maybe that's something for academics or but also not necessarily super accessible. And I see such tremendous potential in both these areas really vastly improving, again, both personal and collective life. But how do you reach people? How do you communicate that to people? How do you get other people to be passionate and get on board? And I had the great fortune in 2012 of being invited by my own church to give a sermon, and then that opened up the door that I've been able to do others. Even though I'm not an ordained preacher, I'm just a lay preacher. But there's something mm-hmm. very, very interesting about giving sermons, and that is I believe that in regular life, people mostly don't want to be told what to do. You know, sometimes we do. Sometimes it's like, well, somebody please give me an answer. But mostly we don't mm-hmm. really like advice all that much. But when I step into the pulpit and I look out at these congregations of people and they're looking at me, you know, and everybody there wants something. So they may want to be inspired. Hmm. They may want comfort. They may want information, you know, but they want something. So I feel like in the sermon, in delivering sermons at any rate, people are wide open to taking in the information. So my hope is that when people pick up this book, they will be similarly really open to receiving the information that is in the book. And the other thing that I think about this format, or at least how I do it, is that it's just really, it's accessible. You know, it's down to earth. Sermons to me are filled with both personal stories as well as information and inspiration. And so I think it's that personal stories that we humans most connect with. We don't, you know, there's been some research that people don't like data all that much, but they like mm-hmm. stories.
Yep.
So my goal with this book was to try to reach just regular folks. You know, it's just regular folks, because I think people can all connect with the stories, and then there is a lot of data. There's a lot of research. There's a lot of information as well. So that's what I'm trying to get these ideas out there in a way that I think people can really grasp onto.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me that sermons, I wouldn't really have expected this, to be honest with you, but as I was reading your book, I said, wow, these are different enough and kind of topic areas which do not overlap to any significant degree that they make not only good sermons but good book chapters.
Right.
So,
well, there was a lot of work in editing it.
I suppose
set out places where there was. Oh, wait, I already said that. But I had a great editor, yes. But there's more I still could write, and you know, and they're all things that I think people can really relate to. You know, like forgiveness, how to handle conflict. The interconnection between human well-being and animal well-being. I mean, there are many, many different ways to go at this, because really, happiness is overarching. You know, it's all our lives, everything we do in life.
You mentioned conflict, and that's actually an interesting point I think I wanted to get to on the program today, because one of the messages I think needs to be conveyed here is that when we talk about happiness, we're not really taking a Pollyannish approach here. I mean, there can be some hard work involved, and there can actually be some anguish on the road to happiness, and you know, so it's not all. I mean, I think you use the metaphor somewhere in the book about roses and thorns and so on.
Right.
It's important to understand that that we aren't just papering over the problems in life here, are we?
No, not at all. And thank you so much for bringing that point up, because it is really important. None of us can be happy 24/7. I mean, it's just impossible, period. And that's just not mm-hmm. what life is. And, you know, to tie it together with what you were saying at the break about Vermont seems to be doing fairly well with our COVID response. So one of the reasons I believe Vermont is doing well is because we are a state with a strong ethos of community and connection and caring for one another, which is another key component of, you know, my happiness isn't just about me. My happiness is about, you know, giving to others and taking care of others. And sometimes that gets messy and sometimes that gets ugly. Conflict is inevitable. It's just inevitable. And so one of the roots to being happier is to better understand sort of the roots of conflict and what some of the skills are for successful conflict resolution.
Where else, is, aside from Bhutan, now is gross national happiness catching hold and starting to influence policy, if it is?
Yes, and so my favorite example right now is New Zealand. New Zealand has, they don't call it gross national happiness, but it is really a gross national happiness system. They call it the people's well-being budget. So, and so that's where their policy decisions are made, in their budget. And it is the same kind of looking at, well, you know, what do we need to provide for the best health care for our people? What do we need to provide for the most equality within our population? What do we need to best protect the environment? It's all built into their budget structure and then how they allocate money. And so systems like this, they don't say, you know, Dave, for you to be happy, this is what you need to do. It's more they look at what support structures our society needs to support that which we know makes people happier and healthier. There are pieces of this happening everywhere. Another really interesting one that I like a lot in Britain. Britain has established a Department of Loneliness because loneliness is epidemic, and loneliness kills people. It also makes people just incredibly unhappy, but it's deadly. In both in Britain and in the United States. So that's another piece of policymaking, which is based on well-being, not just on money coming in and money going out. There have been some cities in the United States as well. In particular, right now, Charlotte, North Carolina, combined with the surrounding county, which is Mecklenburg County, so they call it the Charlotte MEC Well-Being Index, that is in the works right now. And I've gone down there and I've met with those folks. And one thing about their efforts. So sometimes people say, oh, sure, Bhutan could do that. Bhutan is a Buddhist country. Bhutan does not have much diversity at all. It's very homogenous. Well, Charlotte MEC is diverse. And the people who are working on this index together include really, really diverse voices. And they are looking at really, really diverse communities and trying to come up with a new system and a new framework that is to the benefit of everybody. So I'm very excited about what Charlotte MEC is doing, and I think they could serve as a role model for the rest of the country.
All right. We have a caller on the line, a listener, Samantha from Montpelier, is checking in. Good morning, Samantha.
Hi. Good morning, Dave. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Oh, good. Thanks. And hi, Jenny.
Hi, I'm Sam.
How are you? This is a great show. I'm kind of calling with a shameless plug. I work at Bear Pond Books in Montpelier, and we're helping Jenny to launch her book with a virtual book launch on Wednesday evening. And I just want to urge people to attend that and to pick up the book. We do have copies on the shelves right now, and the store is open. It's a fantastic book. And I also want to mention, you know, the title, Preaching Happiness, and the fact that there were sermons that Ginny had delivered. I just want to say, if people are maybe feeling off-put that it might be a religious book, I just want to say that it's not. It's a fantastic, accessible book about everything that you've been talking about happiness on the personal level. I love the information about policymaking and how we can really affect change at the policy level. And I also urge any lawmaker, legislator, senators, they should all be reading this book so that they can see how to best create support systems for well-being. So that's kind of my little plug for the book. And I love the discussion. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Samantha, for the call. Mm-hmm. And that's actually a good point. I think it's worth mentioning that, if somebody's actually looking for a book with a lot of religious content, maybe this isn't for them. But it doesn't have a lot of religious content. It is something which will certainly appeal to secular readers as well as people who are people of faith or whatever. The idea of these being sermons may be a little bit of I don't know if it's quite it's not what I would think of first in that category. It's certainly not Jonathan Edwards or Fire and Brimstone or any of that stuff. You know, it's
opposite of Fire and Brimstone. I think it's fair to say. But yeah. I really do appreciate that point. You know, I should always make that there. It the book is meant to be inclusive. You can be coming to it from any religious faith or no religious faith. Yep. To me, it's spiritual, but I really respect where everybody is coming from in their own spiritual journey. And I try to put things out there as suggestions, as thoughts, as ideas that people can figure out how to make them work in their own lives and in their own journeys. And, it's never about telling people what to do or what to believe.
Yeah. That's an important point about this. When we talk about when the word preaching is in the title, you can't always tell a book by its cover. And
right,
certainly,
right.
There is some aspect of kind of an advice book, about it. It also, as you say, I think you really nailed it, Ginny Sassaman, that the book is much more kind of suggestive than prescriptive, I would say. And one thing I wondered about, in fact, was in terms of, you talk about meditation as a key to happiness for a lot of people.
Yeah.
and its benefits. And I was just thinking, I've had some people on the show discussing the fact that people being home a lot and looking for things to do and maybe not finding productive things to do as much as they should during this whole COVID-19 crisis, a lot more substance abuse going on. We hear reports that liquor stores are sales are going way up and so on and so forth. And I wondered if there's a sort of set of daily exercises or other activities that could be something you do in lieu of, you know, let's say it's 5 o'clock and normally you got to have that whiskey sour or gin and tonic or whatever.
Right, right.
Maybe there's a different kind of happy hour we can prescribe here.
You know, I should work on that. I love that idea. I love that idea. But let me tell you, but let me give you this answer though. These are hard times, and it is challenging sometimes for me as well to keep my spirits up. And last week I was noticing, I'm just not at my best. I'm just not really thriving the way I would like to. So I decided to sit down and think about, what is it that really nurtures me? What is it that makes me, that does grow my happiness and does cultivate my happiness? Because again, I mean, I want to be happy for myself, but also I know that I contribute to the world much better when I am also in better spirits. So I made a chart. I'm a big one for measures and accountability. I made a chart of about 10 different things that nurture me. And And so every day now, I'm noting my goal is to do at least 5 of those things. So it could be meditating, it could be spending time in nature, it could be connecting with a friend, it could be creating art. I think it's really important. People, I think there's this myth about happiness that it's just, it kind of falls out of the sky and lands on us. In reality, it's something to work at.
Yes. It's something to work at. Well, I'll tell you, unfortunately, we're fast approaching the top of the hour, which means we're about out of time here. But I found this to be a fascinating discussion, and I really want to thank you, Jenny Sassaman, for being my guest here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM this morning. The book is Preaching Happiness, Creating a Just and Joyful World. There's a virtual event. When is that, and how do people find it,
So Jenny? It's at 7 o'clock on Wednesday night, and you can go to bearpondbooks.com. to register.
All right.
So people can purchase the book from any independent bookstore or from the publisher, Rootstock Publishing.
Rootstock Publishing, based in Montpelier. Jenny Sassaman, thank you so much for joining me this morning. Great chatting with you. All right. That's about it for today's Dave Graham Show here on WDEV and FM and AM. Have a great afternoon, everybody. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.